From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Before George Porter Jr. became a professional bass player and made the world a funkier place as a founding member of the Meters, he considered becoming a priest. But a childhood retreat into the countryside turned him around.
We couldn't say nothing for that 3 months that I was out there.
3 months?
Well, two and a half months. That was for the whole summer. We was out there for the whole summer.
That is a long time.
And when I got home, I said, nah.
So Porter kept talking and playing. And 60 years later, he's a band leader and session musician with a worldwide following. So do what Paul McCartney, David Byrne, Tori Amos, and the Rolling Stones have already done. Tune in to George Porter Jr. after the break. George Porter Jr. is easy to find because he leaves massive footprints wherever he goes. As a bassist, producer, and founding member of one of the most important funk bands of all time, Porter has shared his talent with artists and audiences around the planet. That's him playing right now. He began playing in New Orleans in the early 1960s. In those days, Porter was a sweet-faced teenager living uptown in the 13th Ward. And nobody lived in the 13th Ward back then without knowing something about music. Singer Art Neville and all of his brothers lived there, as well as Porter's cousin, a young drummer named Joseph Modaliste. Porter, Neville, Modaliste, and guitar player Leo Nocentelli ultimately became the Meters, whose recordings helped make funk ubiquitous in American society. The Meters made the R&B and pop charts, and as a studio band, they supported any number of artists who darkened the door of producer Alan Toussaint's workplace. That's the Meters backing up LaBelle, Robert Palmer, and Lee Dorsey. But the Meters created a wealth of original material in the 1960s and 70s that's been an inspiration to George Porter Jr. and his subsequent bands, including Joyride, The Runnin' Partners, PBS, The Trio, The Meter Men, and The Funky Meters. As a band leader and sideman, Porter remains one of the hardest working musicians around. His latest recording is called It's Time to Funk, and we're delighted that he's here at Marini Recording Studios. Welcome.
That's a hard thing to follow.
We're done.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure completely, really. You know, as you were playing, I was thinking to myself, if Jimi Hendrix played bass, that's what it would sound like.
Oh, wow. He might have bent a little. Did a little bending.
Very nice. Now, I don't know if you know this, but you kind of shimmy when you play, you know? And you shake your ninnies in a way, like a little bit, like a very tasteful exotic dancer. Did you know that?
I've been told that. That's not something I think about, you know. Now I have to constantly watch what I'm doing on stage. That might mess up my aura.
No, it's very affecting. It really is. And because you seem like you're really enjoying yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you?
Yes. I believe that I've kind of at some point have disconnected when I'm in touch with the band, and which is almost like 98% of the time, you know, that the running partners as a band is always in touch with each other. In fact, I mean, I don't play with too many people that I'm not in touch with them musically when I'm on stage, because it's actually a duty as a bass player to be a part of the rhythm section. So if I'm not in touch with the drummer, then it's a serious disconnect going on.
Yes, and your drummer in the Running Partners is Terrence Houston, right?
That's correct, yes.
He's fantastic.
He's a beautiful kid, man. He's a very confident player, you know. He's very confident.
I've always thought of funk music, that is, as sort of a combination of sweat and sex and stamina and ecstasy.
Wow.
Is there anything you'd like to add to that, or?
Syncopation.
Yeah, you got to play the notes, don't you?
You got to not play some of the notes. You know, you got to allow for space, you know. I believe that's probably the most important part of funk, is that there's space in the music. Well, you know, especially as a bass player, I have to, you know, like one of the rules that I have, which I learned from working in the studio with Alan Toussaint, was that there should never, ever be a bass note on the backbeat.
What?
So on a backbeat, if a drummer's playing on 2 and 4, that's his backbeat. But whenever that backbeat happens, there shouldn't be a bass note to cover up that backbeat.
Okay, so what's a typical 2-4 song then?
Well, probably 90% of the songs you hear. So it'd be boom, bop. That'd be the backbeat, you know.
Okay. And
so it'd be boom, bop, boom, bop, you know. So.
And so with a boom, bop, where is your bass there?
On that boom.
Okay, can I hear it?
Well, so if you're saying 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, so there's a note ringing through 2, but it's not a pronunciation. So I'm not playing 1, 2, you know, that's,
yes.
I'm on that note. See, I'm out of the way of 2.
I see. I love that. So you're constantly listening and trying to stay out of the way, but also trying to matter.
Yeah, make the right statements, I'm guilty as probably as any other players out there that tend to overplay. But there's time to overplay, and there's most times when you shouldn't.
Like when you're recording, for instance.
Yeah, or like when you're recording. But now I believe that even in a live performance, you know, it means something to have spaces in the music. It means something that everyone is speaking at the same time, you know, because if we're all playing all over that 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, then, you know, it's like, who are we listening to?
Right.
You know, because we all are playing all on top of each other. We're not, you know, so.
Well, you know, recently you and I, we had an email exchange before meeting today.
Mm-hmm.
And at the bottom of your emails, it says, "You and I working together." Okay. And, you know, that's your tagline, you and I working together. And when I saw it, I thought, George Porter Jr. is a big old hippie. And here you are in your tie-dye shirt.
Don't give it away.
But then I realized that you kind of have to be a hippie in order to understand funk and to play real funk, you know, because as you say, it's collaborative. It's about leaving space for other people. It's about you and I working together.
Yes, absolutely.
I loved it. I liked you immediately because of that, actually. And then also, there's kind of like a philosophy attached to it, you know, that you all are, you know, dreaming something bigger than yourselves.
I like to think so, yes. I mean, you know, I believe that music is bigger than what we can conceive, and that from time and time we have to reach up into that cloud or whatever it is, that air. Mm-hmm. And pull out things to make sense to what's going on around you. And when you're playing in a group, no matter how big or small the group is, if you're paying attention to what's everything that's floating around or over your head, then, you know, then there's going to be some times of some really glorious things that, you know, that only things that happen when it happens, you turn around and you look at the guy and look at him and say, you know, we kind of grin at each other, you know. And I have a bad habit of kind of reading where these other guys are playing at, and I hear them start something and I'll finish it with them, you know, just because I just have been gifted enough, or a little gift, to hear some of these cliches. I know what he's getting ready to say, you know.
You're anticipating.
Yeah.
Well, now, you grew up in the late 40s, 1950s in New Orleans. Can you talk about what your home life was like as a youngster?
We grew up in the Third Ward, which was two blocks from Parish Prison on Gravier Street. You know, as a child, Parish Prison was always a place that we was led to believe that if you screw up, that's where you end up, you know.
Wow.
So that was kind of bred into us, you know, as a kid. You know, you just don't want to visit that place because that's, you know, you just don't want to go there. I went to a Catholic school, and we were, you know, I was an altar boy. At 7 or 8, one of the summers, I went to the St. Augustine ministry out in Bay St. Louis to, you know, to study to be a priest.
Did you?
I realized that wasn't for me. You know? But, I mean, it was something that I wanted to do, but, you know, I think that the fact that the can't talking thing, you know, the whole time we was out there, we couldn't talk. You know, we just, you know, we listened. And I can't think of what that word is for not talking.
Silence?
Yes. But they have another word they use. But that's basically silence. But we couldn't say nothing for that 3 months that I was out there.
3 months?
Well, two and a half months. That was for the whole summer. We was out there for the whole summer.
That is a long time.
And when I got home, I said, nah.
Well, I tell you, I mean, that's pretty amazing, though. I mean, talk about imposing structures, I guess, on your life, you know, living within eyesight of the parish prison, you know, and then also being so involved in the church, you know.
Yeah.
Boy, that's a lot of rules.
Well, you know, two things there. It kept me out of Angola.
True.
So, you know, I believe that somewhere I found a happy medium between being a strict altar boy, Catholic boy, you know, Catholic school boy, and a criminal.
Which, you know, we're all grateful for. And so once you moved up to the 13th Ward, though, what did your house sound like musically?
Well, in the 13th Ward, you know, there was music in the neighborhood. You know, I mean, the Neville pretty much was there. That's when I reconnected with my little cousin, Zigaboo.
Zigaboo Modalese.
And with young Cyril Neville at the time, and I had an acoustic guitar, and Cyril and Zig would be hanging in Zig's side yard, beating on drums and cans and stuff like that, and I would play my guitar. We would be just banging out, you know, old R&B songs, old New Orleans songs mostly.
Like what?
Like Ico's, you know, the Indian kind of things. Tell It Like It Is.
Yes.
I had already been out. You know, some of the art songs, you know.
Art Neville.
All these things had already been out. Something You Got, those kind of songs like that.
There's something you got me. Make me work all day. Something you got, baby.
But I think the majority of my musical knowledge was done when I was 8 years old. I was on Perdita Street at that point.
Okay.
You know, towards downtown. And to walk on Saturdays to catch the bus to go to my guitar lesson. Well, this one particular Saturday, I changed my route. When I turned that block onto Gravity Street, I heard music. And when I got past the corner, I could see it was Benjamin Francis, we all called him Papi, and his grandfather playing guitars on the steps. Mm. And what caught my eye more than anything was the formula that the grandfather was playing. He was playing with that classical formula. The stuff that I was learning at my classes with the songs he was playing, you know, was St. Louis Woman and blues kind of things, you know.
Wow.
And at my lessons, I was learning Home, Home on a Ranch and Red River Valley and stuff like that. But, you know, when I heard what Papi and his grandfather was playing, I said, that's what I want to play. And it was like, this is a no-brainer, you know.
Yeah.
It was a no-brainer. So, you know, and shortly after that, after hearing Papi and his grandfather, I would make it a habit to go around there and hear, just listening at him play, and then go home and practice. And between there and 12, I was, you know, playing blues. My mom took my guitar out of my arms almost every night.
Well, this is between the ages of 8 and 12.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Your musical identity was fixed at that point.
I believe the knowledge of the use of the instrument was fixed, yes.
And so in your actual house, did your parents want to hear music? Did they listen to music on the radio or buy records?
My dad would love jazz.
George
loved
Porter Sr.
Yes, he loved jazz. He liked the keyboard players. So he was in the Jimmy McGriffs and the Jimmy Smiths. He liked Sonny Stitt. Saxophone playing versus the Coltranes and those kind of stuff. He didn't go for those guys too much. He would sit there and listen to some of the record, then he would stop, you know. But Stanley Turrentine, I think, was probably my pop's like favorite saxophone player, you know, because he was just so easygoing, you know.
Dad do for a living?
He was a presser. He pressed clothes.
Oh, wow. And did your mom work outside the house?
My mom was a teacher, school teacher. She taught school for the first 8 years of our lives at the same school we were going to.
So you really couldn't be bad.
Well, it was kind of crazy for me because I remember sixth grade, mom took me out of St. Catherine and I got my first taste of public school.
Mm.
And that almost freaked me out. I just realized that I'm going to go back to Catholic school.
Too soft
no
for public school.
I was easy for the pickers, boy. I like that. I said, oh, you're a Catholic school boy, y'all. That's great.
And so, you know, on your latest EP, which is George Porter Jr. and the Running Partners, and it's called It's Time to Funk, there's a selection of songs that seem to reflect a lot of themes that have gone through your career. You know, over the years.
Yes, it did.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of them is the first one, which is called Nice, Very Nice.
Yeah.
And it's like a classic, I saw you in the mall and yowee, you look good kind of song, right? Which is a universal theme.
It's one of those things where men just can't keep their mouths shut. nice, very nice. You know, didn't require me to do a whole lot of lyric thinking. You know, so, you know, it was just a pure, like, you know, man emotion.
And you wrote it with keyboardist Michael Lemler, right?
Mike Lemler, yeah.
In your band.
It's very Caribbean, you know, it's I like that feeling. You know, and that whole, the whole concept behind that song all happened at one time. You know, I sang the bass line in the mall.
Shopping in the mall, think I look a third time. Nice, very nice, think I look a third time.
That's Nice, Very Nice by George Porter Jr. and the Runnin' Partners. Coming up, a lesson from George Porter. It's not how many Beatles you meet, but whether you meet the right one. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We're talking with George Porter Jr., bass player extraordinaire. Over the years, Porter has been associated with a number of musical acts. But for many, he will always be identified as a founding member of one of the best funk bands of all time. The Meters made most of their recordings in the 1960s and 70s and toured twice with the Rolling Stones. But they also had another job. They were the house band for the record label behind C. Saint Studio here in New Orleans. That's where Robert Palmer, Paul McCartney, LaBelle, and many others made their funkiest records. Producer Alan Toussaint and manager Marshall Seahorn ran the label. And in what appeared to be a conflict of interest, Seahorn also managed the Meters. The band was a popular favorite, but never achieved commercial success.
The Meters did a New Orleans show in London.
Yes.
And after our performance, you know, we had a meet and greet with all of the British royalty bands that, you know, that we all met with.
Right.
Faces, which was turned into Rod Stewart's band.
Yes.
And at that time, Ron Woods was in that band as a bass player. You know, the Rolling Stones, McCartney, we had the one that we was with the longest, him and Linda, you know, and we didn't meet the whole band. We didn't meet the Beatles. Yeah, we might have met most of the Beatles, but McCartney, I remember as being the person that we hung out with the most, the longest.
I love the fact that you can feel comfortable having forgotten whether you met all of the Beatles. For other people, you know, I mean, this would be the highlight of their life, you know, and you're like, oh, well, you know, maybe we met the other three, but we definitely met McCartney.
You know, I mean, you know, actually, because, I mean, you know, you remember people who loved what we were doing, you know.
Yeah.
They were big fans of Louisiana music, of more or less New Orleans music. And so, you know, they were stars. They were treating us as if we were the stars, you know. They came to see us, you know. So it was a humbling situation, but it was like, it made me always believe management was not giving us all of the information that there's more to who you are than what you think you are, you know. And the idea of keeping you at a certain level of consciousness about yourself, you know, served them management purposes more than it served your purposes.
Yeah.
You know, and once something like that happened, we stopped trusting in each other, you know.
You obviously were with C. Saint Studios for a long time.
Yes.
You were the house band.
The house band, yes.
You know, and you all backed up so many different artists.
Yeah.
From Betty Harris and Lee Dorsey, you know, all the way down to LaBelle,
yeah,
right?
LaBelle, right. Mm-hmm.
And that's you on Lady Marmalade, right?
That's correct.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So and so many other hits. And also, it has to be frustrating to see so many different artists, you know, succeed based on your work, or at least in part on your work.
Yeah. We had been opening for bands and, you know, and crushing them.
Yes.
You know, but those bands were getting hit records and stuff like that. And, you know, we were writing and playing really good music.
Sure.
But, you know, but it wasn't getting approached. And, you know, and I still believe until today is that, you know, I don't think it was because the music wasn't good. I just think this was the way it was handled, you know.
Right, but you all were still on the charts. I mean, you were on the R&B and on the pop charts.
Yeah,
you know,
we did make
first
those
albums,
things, yeah.
The Meters and then Look a Pie Pie.
Look a Pie Pie, yeah.
Did very well in Strutton.
Yeah, Strutton didn't do as well, but it got into the R&B charts.
Okay.
And then I believe the Rejuvenation record.
I feel like a king, yeah, 'cause I just kissed my baby. And money don't mean a thing to me, no, 'cause I just kissed my baby.
You know, the band broke up not because we couldn't musically get along. That's the only thing we did well together, was play music, you know?
Yeah, so what have you learned about those kinds of experiences that you can apply to the work that you do today?
Well, I believe, I know, this is only strictly personal, because I don't think that my philosophy can apply to every situation.
Right.
You know, I hear people say things that, man, I gotta like you to be with you. I gotta like you to work with you. You don't have to like me, you just gotta respect me.
Yeah.
You understand? So respect me and let's get some work done. You understand? That's the deal, Jack. You know, if we respect each other and work together at what we do best, and what we do best is play music, you know, then there's a chance that, you know, something real could be reborn. You know, I know we are 70, the rest of us are in our 60s, you know, but everybody's still alive.
Which is the beginning of hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're hearing the Meters with a song called Borrow. Coming up, it's time to funk. George Porter Jr. talks about his latest release, the advantages of sobriety, and why cold cream hurts. Stay with us. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. We're hearing Careful Who You Idolize, which appears on George Porter Jr. and the Runnin' Partners' latest release. The song was co-written by Porter and New Orleans drummer Johnny Vodakovich.
Be careful who you idolize. Use caution when you hit your guru.
Porter Jr.'s EP is called It's Time to Funk and only features 4 songs. But a veteran jam band like his Runnin' Partners can stretch 4 songs into a feast. Jamming is what Porter has been doing for the past 50 years. But some music lovers eschew jam bands. Critics say jamming requires less talent.
Well, there's some validity to that.
Really?
Because, you know, one of the things that happens with a lot of jam situations is that, You know, you're just playing to be playing, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and then there's just chops, you know, for chops, you know? So, I mean, just because you got chops, it's not all the time, it's not that's appreciated, especially by an old guy like myself. You know, I much more prefer to hear you play less that's more meaningful rather than a whole lot. Because then you done said everything you got to say in the first 8 bars of the song. Then what you going to say in the other 100 bars? You know, so there's got to be something, you know, yeah, space.
Ask you this. I mean, how much do you know about music? Do you read music? Do you write music?
I do read, not very good.
Mm-hmm.
I did read very good.
Yeah.
That was 50 years ago. I can read chord charts, the recharge formulas. You know, I can read formulas. And from time to time in sessions, I have to refresh myself on cymbals. You know, on quotas and all that kind of stuff, what I'm supposed to repeat myself and things like that. But today I can look on my cell phone and get that answer right quick, right in between takes. Oh, yeah, okay.
Well, it's amazing. I don't know how you do it in terms of being able to write music, you know, without writing it down. You know, how do you remember you know, what you did?
The tape. There's a machine over there. It has an on button on it.
That's what it is.
Turn it on.
Man, it's true. It doesn't get far from the tape now, does it?
No, you can't get it far away from it. Not anymore, you know, and especially at 67, you better turn the tape on. You want to remember this, turn the tape on.
On your new EP, this is the Running Partners EP, called It's Time to Funk. You know, I love the song that you have, which is called Talking About My Old Friends.
Yes.
Sometimes when the lights are low, I remember friends I used to know. Faces always smile at me, bringing back some memories. Like Tipitina's back in 93, singing things ain't what they used to be. Talking about my old friends. Talking about my old friends.
You and Anders Osborne wrote this song together.
I have been wanting to work with Anders for years.
He's a very strong songwriter.
He's a wonderful writer. So he came to the house, and we talked for about an hour, you know? And then he said, okay, turn the machine on. And I said, huh? He said, turn the machine on. So I turned the machine on, the microphone sitting just about like where you are right now. I just turned it on with no headsets, just turn the machine on and press record. And he sang the lyrics to the song. Just from the conversation that we were having, you know, it was like, wow. I was like blown away, you know.
Wow. And so those old friends, who were you visualizing?
My old friends was Earl King, Snooks Eaglin, and Eddie Bull.
That's a great triumvirate.
Yeah.
It all started when I was young, all the way back around 61. Just a kid checking in. They were doing the trick back in the Popeye too. At the Dewdrop Inn, they played the whole night through. Talking about my old friends. Talking about my old friends. I know I'll see them once again. Talking.
King for me was like, you know, he was like my dad, you know. I mean, with Earl and Eddie Bull, I learned about life as much as about music. Snooks, it was about music, it was about songs.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, only time I get to see Snooks is when we were on stage playing. You know, other than that, Snooks was invisible. And, you know, that's the way he chose it to be. You know, and I got to see him when he was on stage.
All right. We're going to sock it to you, y'all. Baby, please. Baby, please come back to me. Baby, please. Baby, please come back to me. Because I am your prisoner. I need your love to set me free. Can't you hear me now? Yeah.
Are there places around New Orleans when you drive around that remind you of these gentlemen? You know, you must have, like, memories thundering in on you.
Well, I do, but not as much. I mean, Earl is with me every day. It doesn't matter. I don't need anything to think about Earl. He's there. You know? I think he totally inspires me every day to get up and play.
People see me, but they just don't know what's in my heart and why I love you so. I love you, baby, like a mine of gold. So come on, baby, and let the good time roll.
You never let him touch your hair, did you?
Did I?
Let him touch your hair.
No. I never let him do that.
He was supposed to be very good at that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the guys who wore the processors.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I never let him touch my hair.
Love is nice when it's understood. It's even nicer when you're feeling good. You got me flipping like a flag on a pole. So come on, baby, and let the good time roll.
Now, you know, you are known as a first call musician. And, you know, if somebody needs a bass player, chances are they're going to call you first. But what, other than talent, what other attributes do you need to be a first call musician?
Well, I think it has to do with who shows up when you get that call. You know, I believe that at one period in my life, it got to people started worrying about who was going to show up because I was such an addict and I was all, you know, all coked out and stuff. And although I still played very well, but I was a drug addict, you know, so they knew I was going to come and I was going to play, but they just didn't know which one of me would show up.
Your personality would be that day?
You know, and so I realized that when the phone stopped ringing, that it wasn't because the work had went away. It was because I had went away. You know, it wasn't the work. The work was still there.
So steady. It's important to be steady.
Consistent.
Consistent. You know, one of my favorite songs that you sing is from a 2007 CD that's called It's Life.
Mm-hmm.
And the song was co-written by Curtis Mayfield, and it's called Here But I'm Gone.
Yeah.
I love this song. I love the structure. I love the music. I love the horns that come in at the beginning, and then at the end they sound like an ambulance siren.
How did I get so far gone? Where do I belong? And where in the world did I ever go wrong? If I took the time to replace what my mind erased, tell me, darling, I'm here and I'm gone.
That song, it was on his very last recording, New World Order.
Mayfield's, yeah.
And When I first heard the record, when that song first came up, I was driving and I had to pull over because it broke my heart, because it addressed my addiction, although I was already sober. But it spoke to me. It spoke of who I was and what I was all about, and, you know, and some of the things that I needed to say to myself.
How did I get so far gone? Where do I belong? And where in the world did I ever go wrong? If I took the time to replace what my mind erased, tell me, darling,
is addiction something that you think about every day?
Or oh, absolutely.
I mean, but it's been a long time since you've been clean.
28 years.
Yeah. But you still think about it every day?
Well, I mean, I'm still continuously around it. You know, I see it every day. I mean, probably 80% of my audiences are, you know, if I'm not addicted, on their way to being addicted. You know?
Yeah, that's true. And, I mean, I forgot about that. Yeah, musicians are often in that environment where somebody's doing something, you know.
Well, I don't have a difficult maneuvering the waves of the waters anymore because, you know, I have come to absolute certainty that, you know, if I did, it would be over. I would be dead. I would die. You know, I could not go back to where I was. And the stories I heard is that if you start over again, you don't start from new. You start from where you stopped.
Wow.
And if I start from where I stopped, then that meant I have another week to live.
But what's also very interesting, on that same album, It's Life, you have what has become a real battle cry in your concerts, the song I Get High.
Yes.
Every time I think about you, which is just, it turns the whole question of addiction on its head, and it actually makes it kind of romantic.
Yes, yes.
Let's listen to it.
When I'm walking down the street, I love to walk behind you. It's wonderful to see the Lord has been so kind to me. I work hard all my life and I've done lots of things. But baby, when I look at you, girl, it makes me wanna sing.
Love singing that song?
Do I like it? Oh, yeah, yeah. It's on every gig.
Well, I mean, it energizes the entire room. It really does, you know. And you've got so many fans. I think on Facebook you have more than 20,000 followers.
28,000, I believe.
Exactly, 28,000. And a lot of them are not from the United States. I mean, you've got a worldwide following.
Yeah, yes, it is.
You know?
Yeah.
I've seen a group of Turks go mad, you know what I mean, listening to you. I was in Louisiana Music Factory the other day. A Japanese fellow walked in and said, I'm looking for George Porter Jr. music.
Yeah.
Why do you suppose you have such an international following?
Well, I believe the Meters played a very strong role in that, because the fact that out of all the members of the Meters, I was the first one to do the social media thing and all that kind of stuff. Although I believe maybe those other guys were doing Instagram before me.
For our listeners, I want to mention that we're talking, of course, with George Porter Jr., and he and the Running Partners have a new album out called It's Time to Funk.
Yeah, you'll probably be correct in calling it an EP.
Oh, that's true. An EP, and the partners are Brent Anderson on guitar, Michael Lemler on keyboards, Chris Royal on saxophone, and Terrence Houston on drums.
Yes, yes.
I listened to your Christmas album last night.
Oh, you did?
This is an album that you dedicated to your mother,
to my
Henrietta.
Mother, yes.
Henrietta Porter.
Yes.
Is she still with us?
No.
No.
She passed this year.
This year?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. She sounds like a wonderful woman.
Oh, she was great. Yeah, she was my friend.
When I was just a boy, she kissed away my tears. As a man who had lost his way, she brought me home. She got in trouble one Christmas when I got my first guitar. Nothing can replace the things she's taken for me.
What did she think when she heard it?
Oh, she was very happy. She was very pleased. You know, Mom had been, you know, to quote her, she was saying that, when am I going to get a Christmas record from you? Everybody else got Christmas records. Aaron Neville, everybody else got Christmas records. When am I going to get a Christmas record from you?
Bring it all home, children. Bring it all home. 'Cause your mother's love is wrapped up in her arms.
You know, we were talking to another musician, Tom Sankton, you know, the clarinet player. He had written in a book, it was his father's notion, but he said that most great musicians are mama's boys.
I'm certainly one. I am certainly one. You know, well, I mean, the fact that my parents separated when me and my brother was in our early teens, I mean, we learned structure and discipline from mom, you know.
Well, she's a school teacher.
She was a school teacher, yeah. And she had a wonderful right arm.
She was the Punisher, is what you're trying to say.
I'll tell you that. I am afraid to tell it, but she was chastising me one night, and I was walking away from her, and I was mumbling under my voice, you know. And next thing I know, something hit me in the back of the head. And I'm telling you, it was a good 35 feet, away from her.
Really?
She hit me in the back of the head with a cold cream jar.
Pons? Was it Pons?
Pons, exactly. The blue bottle?
Yes, I know.
And she hit me in the back of the head. I went down, and when I put my hand back there, I had this white cold cream with blood in it, you know. And she thought she'd kill me because I was freaking out, and she started freaking out because she thought she didn't really want to hurt me that bad, but she wanted me to know that I heard what you said. and see what you made me do.
You made me kill you.
You made me kill you. Oh, boy, but she threw that with her right hand, 35, 40 feet.
Dang.
And she was right on target.
Wow. Well, I tell you, you know, we're coming to the end of our time, which is kind of a drag because I love talking to you. And
Well, we can do it again.
I hope so. That would be great. And I wanted to ask you something. I saw this on your website, and I liked it a lot, which was a quote from you that said, "I feel like I'm working towards something that will be remembered."
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you, to be remembered?
There's so many of my friends that are here that's not here anymore. And when I sit around listening to what goes on around, you know, I don't hear their music as much as I used to, you know. So, I mean, I would think that, you know, even long after I'm gone, if some part of what I had done musically that survived, you know, me going away, I guess that would be it. You know, I think the meat of music may have a chance at being that, that music. But when, you know, I say me, I'm thinking about, you know, stuff from my solo career, you know, some of the music that I wrote. I mean, talking about my old friends, I wish 50 years from now somebody would still be loving that song, you know, or I Get High. You know, it's those things like that, you know. Then there was another quote, I believe, that someone else saying that if I went away today, I won't feel bad about that I'm leaving because I believe that I gave 100 and I'm not sorry about what happened or what has not happened, you know. So I'm cool.
Thank you. George Thank Porter you. Jr. And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Kayla Green, Garrett Pittman, and Jason Rhine. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For a complete playlist of the songs in this hour and more information about George Porter Jr., go to our website at musicinsideout.org. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, the Arts Council New Orleans, Surf Song Realty of Orange Beach, Alabama, Adam Newman Designs, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.